Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Property Podcast. I'm Rob B with Rob D. And in this episode, well, the relationship between landlords and tenants has been changed forever. The government paper, A Fairer Private Rented Sector, may sound dull, but this report has transformed our industry.
Welcome to the Property Podcast, where every Thursday morning we share for free the lessons that we've learned from our day job of advising a multi-million pound property fund. Today, as Rob said, we are talking about a very important topic, and discussion about this is only going to continue. This is just the start. So now is the perfect time to make sure you're subscribed to us on your favorite podcasting app. It's completely free. All you need to do on Apple Podcasts is hit the little plus button. On Spotify, you can hit follow. Then you'll never miss an episode of the Property Podcast because it'll be downloaded straight to your device every Thursday morning.
So apparently in the news right now, there's a little bit going on politics-wise, and we're going to have a new Prime Minister, I'm told. But this is the Property Podcast, so the most important thing we can tell you about is that there's a new housing minister been appointed. Yes, another one. I know, long-time listeners, you'll be probably sighing at that news. And our new housing minister is Marcus Jones, who's apparently replaced Stuart Andrew, who quit the government post earlier this week. However, with everything going on, this news is possibly even outdated as I record it, even though it's a few days before the podcast goes live, and we might have even another housing minister by then, and it's almost certain that we'll have another one later this year when we get a new prime minister. So, is this news at all? Well, it should be, because a housing minister should have a lot of influence on our lives as property investors or people interested in property. But it's not just the last week's events that have made it unpredictable. It's been farcical over the last however many years, how we just can't have one housing minister stick around long enough to implement anything of note. And it seems to be getting to a point that, is it even worth having the role? Because what are they going to do? They make some announcements and then they disappear. And then very little actually gets implemented. That might be unfair. And obviously I don't see the inner workings of what happens behind the scenes. But it'd be great to get some stability, not just in our own governments across the board, but actually with a housing minister who can start to make changes that are needed for everybody, for people who rent, for people who buy, for people who invest. There is so much that needs to be done, and it's such a shame that it's not happening. And you know what? You never know. I'm an optimist, and maybe our new prime minister will insist on that we have ministers that stick around in positions long enough to make a difference. Based on recent history, it's unlikely. But it's better to be optimistic than pessimistic, so fingers crossed, you never know. Maybe this time next year, we'll be in a much better place when it comes to our housing minister. We, of course, will keep you updated with any future changes made.
We've been waiting for years, and finally, it's here. The most hotly anticipated piece of legislation I could remember in my time in property. The government has finally laid out its proposals on reform of the private rented sector in a white paper called A Fairer Private Rented Sector. This is big news because it includes some major, major changes to the absolute fundamentals of the landlord and tenant relationship. There are some things that we knew about roughly, where we now have more detail, and there are some parts that, frankly, were a complete surprise. Now, it's a long, long document, but don't worry, you don't have to read it, because we have instead. So in this episode, we're going to summarise for you everything that you need to know.
Yeah, this report is a bit bizarre for me, because what you're going to hear is going to completely shake up our industry as investors and landlords. Yet, the coverage it's received has been minimal. And when you've listened to what we've got to cover here today, I think you're going to want to share it and let other people know what's happening, because this really does change the market that we operate in. So let's get into it. So to start off, let's look at how landlords are doing according to this white paper. So they did a study of nearly 8,000 landlords and agents, 7,800 to be precise. And the report said that 30% are demonstrating good practice, 24% mixed compliance, but have done all the safety checks, 35% meeting all the legal requirements, and 11% lower compliance and awareness. Rob, that all sounds nice. I don't know if it means anything to you. It doesn't really mean a lot to me. If 30% are demonstrating good practice, does that suggest 70% aren't?
Well, it's hard to know where one category blends into the next. But for me, what was striking was the low proportion who are doing an objectively bad job. So obviously, some landlords and agents are doing better than others, but only 11% are failing to meet legal requirements. And there's actually another category that they put in there they didn't assign a percentage to because it's so small, called criminal landlords. And I think it's funny because you hear so much about the worst and the actual criminal activity and the landlords who are doing a terrible job, but it's actually a small percentage. It's too high. Obviously, it should be zero, but it's relatively small. So as context for the white paper, I thought this is quite interesting because by and large, it's not that landlords are actually doing anything wrong. They're complying by the laws that are there. But the government clearly considers that the laws that are there are not good enough. So to take an example, it's very rare for landlords to actually kick out tenants illegally, but the government considers that it's too easy to do it legally. So that's the backdrop for this. The paper is called A Fairer Private Rented Sector. And the theme that runs through this is trying to redress a kind of a power imbalance that they believe exists, where landlords have too much power and they're trying to level the playing field a bit. So Rob, let's get into what is actually going to happen. We'll start with the main one. This is by far the most important. We've known for a long time that it's going to be coming, but it's still a big deal. This is the shakeup to the whole notion of how tenancies are structured. And Rob, the fixed term is dead. 6-month contracts, 12-month contracts, no more.
No more indeed. Buy to let has turned into Airbnb because tenants now can just give 2 months notice. So they can take your property, tell you they're going to stay in for many years, but the next day give you notice and then you stay there for 2 months. That's a holiday let. That's not a long-term living situation. That's completely transformed the buy-to-let landscape for investors and landlords and tenants. This is why I'm shocked it hasn't got more coverage and it hasn't got more news. Because it gets better. Because landlords can only evict in certain circumstances, including wanting to sell, but not within the first 6 months of tenancy. So your tenant can leave in the first 6 months, but you can't have the tenant leave. You can still take rent up front, like many people do for student lets, take the 9 months or 12 months or whatever they agree. But if they leave before the end of the tenancy, that must be repaid to them, the proportion that isn't used. So I kind of said it's like Airbnb, but the big difference here is Airbnb, you can assess who's coming in. You can charge a premium for your product because it is an Airbnb and you have a review system and it's kind of the marketplace works. There is compensation for the flexibility that people who operate on Airbnb are given. But this is meant to be for a, you know, a long-term living situation. I'm all for improving a system, but a fair system. And this doesn't seem fair to me. If a tenant can give 2 months' notice at the beginning, why can't a landlord? That's what you would call fair. This doesn't seem fair. And I don't think it's outrageous for somebody to commit to a contract for, say, 6 months. Maybe set a maximum and say, OK, the longest fixed term you can give at the beginning is 6 months, so you get some commitment from the other side. But to be able to walk away 2 months after signing your contract is astounding.
I completely agree. The actual larger change I don't have a big issue with. This is something that some people get very exercised about because as a landlord, they want to have a fixed term at the end of which they can just end the tenancy with no particular other reason being given. And we'll come to talk about reform around evictions in a minute because that ties into this. But as a general principle for me, having a tenancy that just runs on forever unless the landlord has a particularly good reason for ending it, including wanting to sell the property, including wanting to move back in, including obviously their tenant not sticking to their side of the bargain. Don't have an issue with that at all. But it's this 2 months at the start point that just seems weird. Because like you said, Rob, I don't see any issue with just having a minimum 6 month term. It's a minimum term from the landlord side of 6 months, like you said. So why shouldn't it be for the tenants? I don't know to what extent this is going to be abused, if you like, with people saying they're going to move in for years and actually they're gone 2 months later, leaving the landlord with lots of extra costs. Maybe it's going to be a big deal. Maybe it's not. We're going to have to wait and see. But as a principle, it just seems a bit strange.
Well, I mean, for example, you could go, wow, it'd be great to live in London for the summer. So you could go and find a beautiful pad. And if you go through Airbnb, you're going to pay a hefty sum for that. Or you could just find a property to rent. Tell the landlord that you're going to stay for a long time. And then give notice the day after you've signed the contract. And you're there for 2 months. But there's no recourse. There's no, I'll leave that person a bad review. Like, that's it. It's done. Like, they can just move on. And they could do that every year if they wanted to. Now, is everyone going to do that? No, obviously not. But the fact it can be done just seems bonkers to me. How the system was probably too far in the favour of landlords. But how the system is changing means it's way, way, way in the favour of tenants. I think a change had to be made, but it seems like they've lost their senses a bit, or I know this has been levelled at politicians previously, but they've not really thought this through. The minimum 6 months just seems a sensible and fair thing to do for both sides. And the fact that that's been ignored for one side of the transaction just, I don't know, as you can probably tell from the tone of my voice, I'm absolutely perplexed by this one. So when will this happen? Well, it hasn't happened yet. And when it does happen, there'll be 6 months' notice from when we get the date. So they won't say, right, it's happening and starting next week. We will have 6 months to adapt. So that's the tenancy types, Rob. There's been changes around other areas as well, and in particular, evictions.
Yes, this is the other aspect of the changes to how tenancies are structured. Because the reason that lots of landlords are uncomfortable getting rid of fixed terms is that at the end of a fixed term, you can just end the tenancy and it's over relatively quickly and easily. So when you see stats about how many tenancies are ended based on no fault, often there is actually a fault, but it's just quicker to wait for the tenancy to end rather than having to go to court and try and prove that anything's wrong. So that's why this point about, well, tenancies just go on forever is potentially troubling. And so as a result of that, the government is putting some extra protections in from landlords around the area of evictions. So the main point is they're making it easier to remove tenants in situations where they're persistently getting into rent arrears. So there's now a new mandatory ground for eviction, which is where a tenant has been in at least 2 months of rent arrears three times within the previous 3 years. So previously, evicting on the ground of rent arrears was based on the amount of arrears that existed at the time of the court hearing, which made it relatively easy for tenants to stack up arrears, pay down just enough to be under the mandatory threshold of the date of the hearing, and then keep doing it all again. And there's nothing you could do about it. Now this has changed. So if this is a persistent problem, regardless of how much arrears there is at the balance of the hearing, you can evict. The other complaint that you get a lot from landlords is that going to court just takes such a long time. And that, again, is why that it's easier to just use the no-fault route. But the government has promised reform of the courts to speed up the process, and there's various things that they're looking at, including some kind of priority system. So this shouldn't be a concern. So I don't know, Rob, if this actually does all come to pass, then that would make me feel a lot more comfortable about some of the other changes that are made. But this is a real wait and see. It's hard to know just how successful the court reform part of this is going to be.
Exactly. It's great that it's an intention. But again, hopefully you can forgive our scepticism. We've heard things like this before and it's not been delivered. So the intention is good, but let's see what the delivery is. But hopefully it is an improvement on what it currently is. Let's talk about rent increases now. So first of all, rent controls have been proposed by Labour governments at different times. And the report reads that this government does not support the introduction of rent controls to set the level of rent at the outset of a tenancy. Historical evidence suggests that this would discourage investment in the sector and would lead to declining property standards as a result, which would not help landlords or tenants. Obviously agree with that. So what is happening? Well, rents can be increased, but only once per year, and 2 months' notice must be given. So it's just like having a 12-month tenancy agreement, but just without the commitments. You can only change your rent once every 12 months, but your tenant doesn't have to commit for the 12 months. So if the rental market rockets during that time period, and after 6 months you want to move it up, well, you can't. So how do you feel about this? Well, me personally, although it doesn't seem fair when it comes to balancing everything up overall, and this doesn't seem fair that it's only once a year when there's all that flexibility, if you kind of ignore the other points around the commitment a tenant will give you, I know it's hard to do, but if you separate that for a moment and just think about rent increases, I actually do, which may surprise a few people, agree with this one. I think having that security as a tenant to know that rent is only going to go up once per year and that certainty is a good thing. And yes, the market may move in a 12-month period, but it's not going to move that much that suddenly you're going to be way, way, way out during that 12-month period. So it could be argued when you look at the balance of everything we've discussed here that it's unfair, but actually in isolation, I do think it's reasonable and fair. But of course, you're entitled to your own opinion.
Yep, I agree. If you take that on its own, I don't particularly have a problem with it. And I think it'd be very unusual for someone to want to increase the rent more often than that anyway, so not a problem. Okay, let's move on to compliance.
Yippee! Oh, I hope there's more, Rob, because we just can't get enough of this stuff.
I was holding back. I know you wanted to put it first, but I've insisted on moving it down in the notes. The big one here is that there's going to be a new ombudsman scheme, which landlords must join. So on the one hand, another thing to do. On the other hand, kind of makes sense, because if you're going through a letting agent, then there is a redress scheme, there's a complaints procedure, there's the ombudsman to go to, and there's some sort of redress. If you're renting from a private landlord, then there's none of that. So I kind of understand that one. Another compliance change gives you another job to do. You'll notice that none of this ever involves removing anything. It's always adding new things on top. That now all properties must be listed on a new digital property portal, which means that important compliance information, like safety certificates and things like that, will be visible to tenants and to the council. So it's taking all the important stuff and giving better visibility of it to people who have an interest in that information. I suspect, given the way that government IT projects normally work, that it may be a while before this one sees the light of day. And the other minor kind of footnote in compliance is there's now going to be a blanket ban on renting to families with children or people on benefits. In practice, I don't think that really means much, because all it means is you can't advertise as no families or no benefits, but you can still, of course, take applications from whoever you want and then make a decision on whichever grounds you want. So I don't know if that really changes anything. But Rob, taking this section as a whole, I can see the logic for all these changes, and I don't necessarily object to any of them, but it does just mean that there's yet more to do when it comes to renting out a property.
Yeah, and again, I don't particularly object to anything in particular. It's just, yeah, more. It's just more. Right, moving on to pets. So there are changes around pets, and you can no longer unreasonably withhold consent for pets. But what you can do is insist that the tenant takes out pet insurance, which I assume covers the cost of any damage made. I have mixed feelings on this one, and it's going to show my selfish side. I quite like that I was open to pets as a landlord already, because it was like a unique point of reference that, okay, well, I'm more open, so therefore I might attract more tenants. And with portfolio as well, we've allowed pets into the properties that we look after. So it just means the playing field's been levelled, but I think overall, for those with pets, they'll feel quite happy. Some landlords may feel nervous about this, and I understand why. But as somebody who has a dog and has previously had goldfish and is quite comfortable of letting their own properties out to people with pets, I think I'm okay with it, but I understand why others may not be.
Yeah, so again, it's not quite as dramatic as it sounds, because it's about withholding consent for pets. So if somebody already has pets at the point of moving in, you can just choose to not accept that and take a different applicant instead. But if someone then says that they want to get a goldfish, then you can't object to it if you wanted to for some reason. A lot of this is going to come down to what the definition of unreasonably withhold means. I don't know what the difference between reasonable and unreasonable is here, but the solution to this I don't like. This was kind of a solved problem in that before there were the restrictions that came in on how much of a deposit you could take, it was normal to take an additional pet deposit, which recognized the fact that pets do just cause more potential damage and wear and tear. So you would insist on taking a larger deposit from someone with a pet than you otherwise would. Didn't see an issue with that. This insurance point seems like it creates extra costs for the tenant, but doesn't necessarily actually do anything for the landlord, because I believe that the insurance only pays out if there is some defined incident, there is some specific piece of damage. Whereas if there is just generally more wear and tear, or if you have to get the property cleaned more comprehensively at the end or whatever, I don't believe the insurance would pay out for that. So this seems like a suboptimal solution. But like with all this stuff, we're going to have to wait and see how it beds in and how it actually works in practice. It's also worth saying that while this isn't just a consultation, it isn't actually the law yet. This is white paper laying out what the law is going to be when they put it before Parliament. So while they're not asking for feedback, there is still a chance that some lobbying will go on, or they'll realise they haven't thought things through and some of this will change. So it's too early to start worrying about the detail of all of this and exactly how it's going to play out. But Rob, of course, there have been some specific objections that people in the industry have raised to all of this already.
Yeah, the big one is the fact that tenants could leave after 2 months, you know, the point that kind of got us a little bit excited. That is the one, understandably, that has got most people kind of wound up, scared, what use the emotion of choice that you want to pick, but yeah, has got people emotional on one level or another. Another point that people are really upset with is it's going to be hard when you're renting to students now, because you may previously have said, right, I want 12 months because that's your model and your particular property was really desirable and you could ask for 12 months. But now students will more likely use the term that suits them, which means that you have that empty window of the summer months where you're unlikely to have it let. Or if you do let it, it's for a lot lower amount. But if you do let it for a lower amount, it means those people can stay there into the new term anyway, so you probably wouldn't let it for a lower amount. Now, I think people will adapt and they'll just put the rents up with the expectation that people will leave. Now, will that be achievable? Because obviously the whole market needs to move to do that, and it's not just a decision of one landlord. We'll see. That's how I could see it happening, but time will tell. If you are in the student let market in particular, your life has just got a lot harder and your business model has got a lot worse. Not great. I'm not really ending this one on a high, Rob, but for those who interact with students, it's not amazing. Also, those who are operating in areas that would be really popular for Airbnb, like central London and, you know, places like Cornwall and the Lake District and other places like that, if you currently choose to do long-term rentals in those areas, then you are really vulnerable to having your property used during peak seasons just with this 2-month rule. Now, that might be a little bit niche, but it's still a risk. While, Rob, I don't feel this is fair, I'm hoping common sense will prevail overall by everybody who interacts in this market and the abuse will be minimal. And while it all feels raw and unfair at this present moment in time, hopefully when this all plays out, the notice period situation doesn't become too bad and isn't abused to a silly extent, and it's just isolated cases rather than it's being done across the board.
Yeah, I would like to think, like I said, this isn't absolutely set in stone. If there was one point that I would hope to see change, it was this one. And if you look at it, this is the only real point in the whole thing where we said, oh, really don't like that. It's only this 2 months notice at the start of a tenancy. If that changed, I could very comfortably get behind everything else. Like we said with some of the compliance points, it's really annoying that there's even more to do now and it's getting a bit much, but I do see the point for each of them. And as a general principle, I'm super pro rental reform. I think that renting in the UK is a terrible experience and it shouldn't be. We've talked about this extensively before. So as a principle, I'm all for it. And I think it's worth being aware that whenever anything is suggested, there's this general knee-jerk thing in the landlord community where they get very upset about any kind of change. And some past reform has actually been really positive. So if you remember a few years back, tenant fees got banned. So landlords and agents couldn't charge outrageous fees to tenants at the point of taking out a new tenancy. And everyone was up in arms about this at the time. And it was going to be the absolute end of everything. It was going to destroy the industry. It was going to put everyone out of business. And of course, it was going to be the poor tenants that would ultimately suffer because it was going to push up rents because everyone would put their rents up as a consequence. None of that happened. It removed an unfairness in the system. Everyone got used to it and carried on. And as a result, renting is less terrible than it used to be. So I think reform in general is a good thing. It's a sector that really needs reform. Most of what's in there takes a little bit of getting used to, but will be totally fine. There are just these one or two niggles, Rob. So it'll be interesting to keep an eye on this. And we can hope that those one or two bits do change. And then I think we'd feel a lot more positive about the whole package.
It's time for Hub Extra. We just like to carry on giving the value the whole way through this podcast. And a Hub Extra is our way of doing that. We give you a resource, a quote, something that's just going to improve your life a little bit more. And this, of course, is all backed up by our newsletter, which you can get via the Property Hub website. Go to propertyhub.net and sign up there, and you will get it each and every Friday. And this week is a podcast. And actually, it's a podcast I am sure we've recommended many, many years ago on Hub Extra. And it's the Tim Ferriss podcast. So why am I reintroducing it? Well, I stopped listening to the Tim Ferriss podcast because it went on for hours. Each episode was hours long and the guests looked really enticing, and very occasionally I would persevere and get through it, but I just don't have that attention span. You know, committing 2 hours to one podcast is a big ask for me, and I'm sure a lot of other people. So I was very pleased to see when I went back to look through his feed to see that he is now doing a best of the month episode, which is less than an hour. So he takes all the best bits of that month and condenses it down into 1 hour, which is great for people like me who are busy and want the best bits but don't want to go through all the waffle. And I'm sure the waffle is interesting and entertaining as well, but if you can get the highlights, why not just skip straight to it? So that's what he started to do. So if, like me, you've given up on the Tim Ferriss podcast, you may want to go back and check it out. And if you've never given it a go, well, maybe now's the time to have a little look and see if it's for you.
Well, no need for such a roundup on the property podcast, where we're always super brief and focused. Well, most of the time, anyway. That is us done for this week. I know you're going to have thoughts on today's topic, so let us know. We're on all the socials at Property Hub UK, and we talked about portfolio earlier. You can find out more about that at portfolio.co.uk. Hopefully you're subscribed. If not, put that right, because then we'll pop up again in your feed next Thursday for another episode. So we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.